back, everyone. Today, I'm actually joined with Agent Ivy. We're going to discuss Dougie Milford and all this history throughout the secret history of Twin Peaks and in season two. But before we go too much further, I don't have the mic so she can introduce herself further.
Hey, Colin. I'm Allison. For anyone who doesn't know, and I go by Agent Ivy out in the Twin Peaks universe. I'm really glad to be here, and I'm totally stoked to be getting to talk about Dougie Milford. For anyone who knows me and who knows how I feel about Twin Peaks, the secret history of Twin Peaks is like, it's deep and it's real and it's very meaningful for me. So getting to really dive back into it, because it had been a while, was so fun. And I'm really glad to be having this conversation with you.
And I guess to start off with Dougie Milford is, we probably should start off with the earliest parts, is that he was the black sheep of the family. He failed pharmacy school in Yakima, and he wasn't interested in the family business all around. To kind of further add to it is that Andrew Packard wrote on June 21st of 1927 his diary, Dougie Milford was living in sin with Pauline Cuyo, who was the estranged daughter of the Twin Peaks Gazette owner. So we're just kind of setting a precedent before we even get into his career. What should we say about Dougie Milford and like the type of person he was at this point in his life?
It's a good question. And I think, you know, again, because we didn't know him until the secret history, so you kind of have to fill the blanks in for him, right? So we know from the beginning that he was considered the black sheep of the family. And so you have to figure out, what does that actually mean? I mean, Dwayne talked about his lamentable defect in his character, you know, when he was discussing the Boy Scouts. So I think, you know, the fact that he was living with a woman, shacking up with a woman, just shows that he was kind of a sort of a free thinker, a little bit wild, definitely nonconformist.
This is all going to kind of tie into like the big thing that really set him off, is that he worked with his brother Dwayne Milford as a scoutmaster. And this actually happened, it was before Andrew Packard wrote his note or his newspaper article in the Twin Peaks Gazette. They did not get along this time. The thing that set it off is that Dougie Milford claims to have seen a giant in the woods, and everyone, including Dwayne, dismissed it. Dougie later claimed to see a walking owl that was as tall as a man. He took photos of the giant owl, but the shots were prematurely exposed. Yeah, so we're already talking about like the fantastical elements of what Dougie Milford saw. But I'd say that even though this happened just a little bit prior before Andrew Packard, what do you think it was that set Dougie Milford off when he saw these, you know, the fireman and the owl, but not Andrew Packard when he saw the fireman?
So because of what we know Dougie's life is going to unfold into, and this is something that I kind of got through this last deep dive into it, is that Dougie is tapped in. He's a chosen one. And so his connection to whatever you want to call it, the others, the supernatural, whatever that stuff is, I think it really affects him in a much deeper way. When you ask me the question, that's really what comes to mind, is what the difference is in their reactions to it. Because, you know, one part in the book, which is a little bit down the line, but there's, or maybe this was from an ancillary piece of writing that I saw, but it was like when he's in a situation deeper into the story and he's describing the situation, he's describing much more about how he feels than what he's seeing. He's a velvet steamroller. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that might actually substantiate that, is that later on, Tammy, she actually writes about how, quote unquote, flood of memories, that that's how it sounds like an onset of a panic attack. And she does talk about how Dougie Milford, how he was experiencing what was his own equivalent of like a close encounter, almost like in a sense of like an alien or an extra dimensional being. Do you think that there's anything pertaining to not just the firemen or the owls, but aliens at large at this point?
Well, this is a good question too, because again, and this is something I went back and forth and back and forth. This happened at Pearl Lake, right? This event with the owls and stuff. So it gets, because it gets referred to later in the story, and then it says when he talked about Pearl Lake, and I was like, so it must have been that. So look, Colin, I go a little bit dark on this, maybe because of the story of Twin Peaks at its core is a story about, it's all of this peripheral stuff, but at its core, it's a story about a young woman who's, you know, molested and murdered by her father. And so throughout this book, I think especially with the layers and layers of conspiracy theory and the government and secrets and mysteries and all of that stuff, that you also have a lot of mention throughout this book about societies and clubs and right secret club, like, I mean, of course we've got the Freemasons and the Illuminati, that whole thing, but the Boy Scouts as an organization has a very checkered history. And so I kind of thought, like, not only is it possible that Dougie, in this, that Douglas in this time actually, based on what the book says, has a interaction with others, right? In addition to just seeing the owls and the giant, perhaps, that there's more to the story, that we're just, to the Boy Scouts. I know I'm going deep and kind of dark, but it just, I think it's a possibility. And that's layered on top because he's messed up, Douglas, right? I mean, emotionally.
Not sure if this is really what you're alluding to, but there's this whole dynamic of when Dougie talks about this stuff, there's this whole aspect that people just outright don't believe him. When we're talking about the darker aspects of the Boy Scouts, is that something that you're alluding to, or you think that Mark Frost was going for?
I don't know, but I just, I mean, I know we're being coy and going around it because we can just infer what we're both talking about here. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing in this book that says it outrightly, but it's just a lot of these clubs and societies, and they've got weird stuff, So yeah, I don't know. I'm again, that's a leap. But if we're going back purely to the question of whether this was an encounter of an alien, quote unquote, alien type, I think it's possible based on how it's presented throughout the book that this was his first experience with that other outer being.
One thing I think that ties into the fantastical aspect, and also the talking about people not believing Dougie, is that he does take the photos of the giant and the owl, but because they're prematurely exposed, people dismiss it. But we need to mention is that Andrew Packard, he saw the footprint of the giant, and Duane Milford was with them, and they put that in. If it wasn't the Twin Peaks Gazette, it certainly Major Briggs had it in the dossier. So again, is there something we should talk about Dougie having this encounter that's debunked or dismissed rather? And then Andrew Packard has the, he happens to have the photography, but people seem to believe him and then warm up to it more.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it kind of just sets up the fight is really what it does, right? I mean, he has this encounter, so you get it very early on that Douglas is different, right? It was like Dwayne said, he has a photographic memory. There's something about him that is different and that he's tapped in a way. And because he has this experience, nobody believes him, and then he gets kicked out of the Boy Scouts. Right? I mean, it sets up that fight, that tension, which I think it serves that purpose as well.
I think one thing to build off from that is that because of this encounter that he had, that he disappears for days, and it's alluded to that he may or may not be investigating these fantastical encounters. But not only does his relationship with his brother get more strained, but he actually punches Dwayne at a meeting in Spokane, and his request to investigate is what gets him expelled along with that. So we're kind of with someone who's like a bit directionless, doesn't have a relationship with his brother. I mean, out of the two, it seemed like even before these events that Dwayne was the more well-respected one. Just at least the way that Dwayne Milford is presented, up until that point. That's kind of the impression that I got. But should we talk about anything about the relationship between the Milford brothers that will go on for decades to come?
I think that's pretty much it, right? One, they're very different people. They have different perspectives. One is a much more conforming and, wants things done in a certain way. I mean, again, there's a lot to infer about Douglas this early on in the book too, about what kind of a person he is. But when you hear he's the black sheep of the family, yeah, he's like the outcast. He probably himself feels like he doesn't fit in, So I would say that that's, but as far as the brothers go, I think it just sets it up for them to always be at odds with each other as siblings.
For Dougie, he does seem like he rebounds well, all things considered, because he is managing a pool hall on the bad side of town. It's also insinuated that he may or may not be sleeping with Pauline still on the side. Dwayne wonders if he judged Dougie too harshly, which I'm kind of surprised by that introspection. And actually, he does also think that Dougie may or may not stage the ordeal. I don't know. It's just like, again, we're kind of talking about like the brothers' strained relationship, but it's like I was saying before, is that Dwayne and Andrew Packard saw the footprint of the giant, but here he is challenging his brother not long after this event.
And even suggesting that he set it up, where the other, I think it was one of the Boy Scouts, was like, I don't think that's possible. It was just way too, it would have been way too crafty to make that happen. So I don't know. It's a really good question. I didn't really think too much about that aspect of it, why people didn't believe him and they didn't want to hear it, other than maybe it just punctuates the point that the people who have those experiences are oftentimes shunned, even if there's evidence for it.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, I know that's still a problem to this day, but certainly 1927, that was also another factor.
Major.
I think one thing that might allude to, what we were talking about Dougie not being believed is that the archivist, who I think for this sake we could probably just refer to as Major
Oh,
Briggs,
yeah, I think so. There's no spoilers.
but he talks about how Dougie became the town drunk. Dougie left Twin Peaks early on in the Great Depression. He was just kind of drifting around throughout the 30s. I think he was like riding the rails primarily. He does marry Pauline Cuyo around that time as well. Cut to the 40s, specifically the day after Pearl Harbor, and he enlists in the army. Now we're about to get into like his career and when he becomes a little more focused, but anything we should think about his life in the 30s or anything to keep in mind for his army career forward?
Well, I don't know, that piece of the story is pretty short. I mean, Mark Frost has an economy of words. I've calculated, I think he was 20 at the crash of 29. So by the time he enlists, he's 32. There, it obviously didn't get much attention from Mark Frost about what he did in those years, because he was just basically, again, he leaves Twin Peaks, he gets away from his hometown and he just does what he wants here and there until he realizes, I don't know. I mean, again, we have to come up with a story for why he decided to enlist. Because somebody who's a drunk, who doesn't care about life and isn't an honest person and and is very troubled, is only going to end up enlisting in the army, in the military for very specific reasons. So either he was really looking for structure, or he realized that he was just drinking to suppress his anger and shame and upset or whatever it was, and that it's not really who he was and that he wanted a different life.
Maybe I'm reading too far into it, but I'm just thinking is that for anyone who's read Conversations with Mark Frost or follows him on social media, is that he's very much well engaged into politics of yesteryear and today. And I think that there's a bit of a reflection that during this time, because the 30s, because of the Great Depression, it was just this era that I think people didn't really know how to feel. And it's also worth mentioning is on this topic is that when FDR introduced the New Deal, there wasn't really a clear-cut solution. It was just like, let's throw anything to the wall and see what sticks. And I think that kind of fits in. And the reason why I'm saying this is that it was actually ironically Pearl Harbor and World War II that kind of like got the economy back in that direction. And I think with tying back to Dougie is that I think after feeling so directionless, there's that like patriotism that just shoots in like into you, when you find out that like you've been attacked by like, in this war. And so I think that that's like a thing that really sparks Dougie is that, after having like this thing going on and like feeling down and out about himself and like the world just seems like it's not getting better, that there's this thing that he feels like that's like a larger part than himself. And
Definitely.
we'll talk
Very
more
good.
about Dougie as a character, and like how he behaves and like whether it's good or bad. But I think at least that's what set the precedent for why he enlisted the day after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, for sure. Definitely.
He does seem like he ascends relatively quickly because he becomes a sergeant by late 1944. He is admittedly charged with black market trafficking, mostly with liquor and alcohol. Tammy says the charges were dismissed and that he was demoted. Not everything's perfect, for this guy who is directionless and doesn't have a family. I don't know, you kind of take and t give and take what you can get.
Right. It's a technically a criminal activity, but you have to wonder what is the motivation. So it's either personally motivated or he's doing it to help people who need cigarettes and candy or whatever it is. I mean, we don't really understand his motivation. His character never struck me as like a two-bit dime store criminal. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. So we don't know his motivation for it, but it was the catalyst for him to get reassigned.
And actually, this is where we're going to start getting to some of the more fantastical stuff early on. But he starts working as a buck private at White Sands Missile Range in 1945. I can't help but think that the indirect relation to Part 8, and I know
Course.
that talking about Part 8 this early on relative to Dougie can go off in any directions, but is there anything we should mention about White Sands, whether it's how Jack Parsons relates to it or how Dougie Milford, like how much he knew or didn't know about White Sands Missile Range at this point?
Well, I mean, it's so modestly conveyed at this point in the book. I agree with you. I think cracking it open in the big scheme of things, if we just say at this point, like, it's a direct connection to episode 8 of The Return, that he was at White Sands, right, to be part of the Manhattan Project and Trinity, just because of all of it. So I kind of feel like we could get to those larger pieces as the story unfolds.
I think that the reason why I mention this now is that Jack Parsons, I think, was working in relatively close proximity for Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And of course, we'll get into when Dougie and Jack Parsons meet, but it is kind of strange that those two have like some indirect interaction and are in close
Oh,
proximity.
I see what you're saying. Yes, right. That they're that. Yeah, I mean, and he when they when he goes to meet with him, he asks him, do you know White Sands? I mean, they're so yeah. They had sort of a little bit. I guess you're suggesting that there's a like a parallel track, and that they were close in geographical location at the same time. It's interesting to think about. Was Jack at White Sands?
I think it
Did
was at
he?
least assigned, because I know it's been a long time since I really did my research about Jack Parsons, but I do know that he at least thinks there's a big significance of White Sands. And if he wasn't working there for Jet Propulsion Laboratory, I think he was at least there with L. Ron Hubbard when they tried to summon the Moonchild. So there is at least that
Right.
esoteric part.
Yes. Right. Yes. And so it's like, it's that ripping open of the time space continuum with the explosion, right? With the test, with the Trinity test. Yes, I agree. It is a rabbit hole.
We should mention is that the careers were different because with Jack Parsons, we can say what we will about him as a person, but because of what he did with JPL, is that that's what would get us to the moon decades later. And right now, Dougie in 1945, he's working in hazard duties for the Manhattan Project, but his trajectory really changes when he shows up to Roswell, New Mexico in July of 1947, and is also present during the UFO crash. Yeah, he states in an interview on July 7th of 1947 that he saw the crash site up close. There's a recording that's interrupted after Dougie mentions General Nathan Twining being at the site. The rest of the conversation, when the tape goes on, if it's scripted. Before we get too much further about Roswell, New Mexico, or the UFOs, is there anything we should mention about where you stand on like the UFOs in of themselves, or how Dougie Milford factors into it?
Well, that's a big question. You mean like, do I believe in UFO alien UFOs?
Yeah, we can start with that.
That's a good question. I don't know, through all of this, I guess I feel like I don't have a strong opinion about aliens, unidentified flying objects. I'm definitely not on the conspiracy side of it, but I do think that the more likely it's hard to say, Colin, I mean, because it's such a big topic, right? There have been sightings all over the world. So you can't just generalize it to America because there have been sightings everywhere. But for my own small pea brain in this context, I would say that to me, it's more likely that UFOs are not extraterrestrial, that they're something else that could potentially be explained. But of course, there would have to be a very big conspiracy to cover up. The story, like, I mean, I know we're going to get to Maury Island, but the story of the planes dropping nuclear waste into the ocean, like, that seems plausible to me that that's a possible thing, but that would have had to have been a very big cover up. So the whole thing kind of confuses me.
Oh no, yeah. I mean, I know, like I said, it's a huge topic. I
Yeah.
guess where I stand, if we're going to go through the lens of Twin Peaks, I think of again, and I was mentioning conversation with Mark Frost, but I forgot how it came up exactly in the book. But David Bushman was talking about it with Mark Frost, and Mark Frost said that he was thinking about instead of having the ambiguity of the owls, but it would be more of an implication that the owls were aliens. Again, I know aliens and UFOs are a bit of a false equivalency, but I think there's at least that indirect connection with Mark Frost because he wrote this book and was questioned about it in conversation with Mark Frost about that there's something else like that's otherworldly or like not from this planet. From my stance though, I do know that with Roswell, I think it was pretty much like not really on anyone's radar for at least 40 or closer to 50 years. It wasn't until like 1990 or even
Yeah,
1997
that it
that
sort of roared back. It's interesting too in the construct of the book that it's the three of them, right? It's Kenneth Arnold, Maury Island, and Roswell. Roswell was the last one, but Mark Frost puts them out of order. And I never quite got, I mean, it was obviously to unfold the story the way that he wanted to, but that's how they went. So I mean, Kenneth Arnold's story was much bigger. And yeah, the Roswell thing came back at a much later date, which is interesting that it became part of the popular culture of ufology. The other thing I wanted to say about the owls too, which it's been a while, but when I first was really diving into the secret history, I don't know, a couple of years ago, there's a book called think it's called The Messengers. Part of the book is that owls tend to show up when there are UFO sightings. That's part of it. So I have to believe that Mark Frost had that in his toolkit also.
One thing that might tie it into this, and like I said, you know, that UFOs, unidentified flying objects, and aliens don't necessarily mean they have to correlate, but just that in season 2, episode 10, when Major Briggs is, I guess, well,
Yeah,
abducted,
abducted.
Dale Cooper sees the owl, and then the way that Garland screams Cooper, there's that blinding light, and there's like a silhouette of at least an entity,
Yeah.
and yeah, Garland disappears, and he comes back in a different, you know, wearing something from like 100 years prior, or
Right,
maybe 80 years
he
prior.
turns into Snoopy while he's gone.
But yeah, it's just like, you know, you see this thing where like it was like seemed like it was alluding to aliens at a certain point, and then Project Blue Book's mentioned, and that also has a whole factor. So I think at least if Mark Frost was thinking about aliens and you know, trying to integrate that into season two, you know, there wasn't much trajectory because the show was canceled and didn't get in the return. So this seems like it's like the main area where he can really bring it up.
I agree. Because it was introduced in the way that it was in season two, it was, to me, it absolutely opened up the path for it through this book because it was such a, it was just like a nugget in the show, kind of. But yeah, it's that whole sequence goes very well with this book.
I was mentioned before is that Dougie, when he mentions General Nathan Twining being at that site, it should be addressed that Twining is actually confirmed by both Major Briggs and Tammy that he was working closely on the early UFO projects after World War II. Then also, Dougie's name is on the report regarding Kenneth Arnold on July 12th of 1947. And this is when Kenneth Arnold says he saw 9 UFOs, and that was reported in June of 1947. So you were right about like mentioned that there was other UFO events that were going on before Roswell, but just that Roswell was like the one that just kind of became the spectacle out of them.
Yeah, and I don't really know if I tripped over why that is. I'm sure there's lots of theories on why it became so. Do you know why did it come back so popular?
The only thing I could feasibly think of offhand, it's like what I was mentioned before, is that Roswell was kind of this like tightly guarded thing until the 90s, and then it just kind of had this like big splash afterwards. Because I don't really remember seeing anything about Roswell in, like the pop culture before 1990. Like even Colin McLaughlin, he was on the show Roswell.
Right.
So the 90s was kind of that era where just like, you know, there's that, there's Independence Day, Mars Attacks, there's all these movies
Yes.
pertain to aliens and UFOs. Some more like outlandish than others, but it's just that it wasn't quite in the culture. Obviously we had Close Encounters of the Third Kind, but we didn't really, you know, it wasn't like the in the zeitgeist the way it was in the 90s.
Yeah, you know, that's so interesting, Colin, because of how, you know, art imitates life, imitates art, that the popular entertainment of the day informs the, I don't know, the social understanding, the societal understanding of what's happening in the world. You know what I mean? That's really interesting, actually, that it's just a ref it's one can reflect the other. Yeah, I mean, it was a big time for UFOs at that time. I mean, there were a lot of sightings going on.
And actually, on the topic of a lot of sightings, this will tie into more about the UFOs and also how Dougie factors into it. In July 14th of 1957, there was a receipt for a Buick in Seattle, and it was priced at almost $2,000, which was certainly in 1947 a lot of money. This was during the time when there was 850 reports of UFO sightings in like those subsequent weeks. We have to talk about the character of Dougie and like what he's doing for with his career, because he appears to have strong-armed Harold Dahl into silence of UFOs. This was in Volume 1 of Fate. The way Harold Dahl was strong-armed is that his son disappeared for days after this. You know, the fact that Dougie Milford, that he can like strong-arm someone and seems like he may or may not have had a role in abducting this person's son. It's around when I did this research on Dougie Milford. It went over my head when I read The Secret for the first time, but truly sent down folks on Doug is like, Dougie might not be a good person, or at least like he's doing something that's more definitely shadow government and is asking for a lot of unethical stuff to do.
Yeah, he's a spooky guy, which is, you know, I mean, at one point one of the notes that I took was, you know, he's going to obviously come in contact with Nixon pretty prominently, and that Nixon, he said, Milford maintained his reputation as the most ethical, dispassionate, and trustworthy case officer in Project Blue Book's history. So then again, right, it's like what's your perspective on ethics? You know, how it's selective reasoning around what's ethical and what's not as it applies to whatever it is that you want to do. So I agree. I mean, with the Buick and the Kenneth Car I mean, he goes to see Arnold, right? He has a meeting with Kenneth Arnold, and that's where it kind of feels like the Men in Black stuff kind of starts, right? I mean, because he's now got the Buick, and where did he get the money, right? I mean, it's a good question, right? Do you have a theory about that?
I think that at this point, he was able to, because of what he could see in Roswell, he had some sort of leverage over General Nathan Twine, of all people. And I think that during that time when the recording stopped, that he must have said something, or he found a way to kind of coerce his way into like a higher position of power. You know, and I guess we should mention is that we don't know how Dougie felt personally, certainly not at this point, about how he felt about doing this part of the job. Whether it was like a unnecessary evil, or if it was like something
Right.
that he like, I don't know, that he was fine and kind of was like fine with doing all this. But yeah, I think that there's like he kind of saw a career opportunity after the UFO crash, and because of his affiliation with Nathan Twining, that he was able to get to this position. And this won't be the last time we mention Nathan Twine as well. So, but I
Yeah.
will say though is that you know, he does disappear a few months later in Ohio. And then he shows up at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and this is for the first official meeting of Project Sign. And all this is confirmed by Tammy, by the way. So I think there's, you know, the fact that she can look this up and she can substantiate it, that this does say something that, you know, Dougie Milford, he can disappear for a set period of time, but he can also just show up to these like major events of like behind the scenes of like a shadow government, if you will.
Right, because she says that thing about how he like flickers in and out. Tammy uses that language that he, I can't remember where that note, I have that note written down somewhere, but that she said something like, Milford just flickers in and out of these events in a very, you know, in a way that's very, what's the word? Slippery. Right. So yeah, he's behind the scenes and he's working the spooky stuff.
I said that we'd mentioned Nathan Twine earlier, you know, later on, but actually, he actually is at in attendance in this meeting. So it's like what I was saying before is that I think he was able to have leverage on Nathan Twining to get to this position. But I think now we can talk about the reports about UFOs because there's an emphasis on reports 2, 4, 17, and 18. The 2 and 4 are completely redacted, but the last two, 17, 18, were in Twin Peaks. And also, I think it's probably important to mention is that the Major Briggs says that Dougie is now a U.S. Air Force major. Again, this is why I mentioned before is that he has to have either some dirt on General Twining or like he has a good relationship because going from enlisting the Army in 1941 to being a major in the Air Force in 1947, that's a big
It's a
leap.
big leap, right? He also could have, you know, these people that he works for who Twining has no idea, right? I mean, that's sort of the suggestion too, that the layers of people involved are in the shadows, kind of, right? And that he has this secret, this network of people. But I agree. I like the idea that he's got something on Twining.
Maybe a lot of this is due to how he handled the Maury Island incident, which we alluded to earlier, because you know Dougie was someone that was totally fine with like kind of rolling up his sleeves, getting his hands dirty, and strong-arming people in silence. And that's not the first or the last time he'll do it, because you know, as mentioned, entry 17 and 18 about the UFOs being in Twin Peaks is that the 17th entry was Einar Jennings 4 days beforehand, and then the 18th one was actually Dougie Milford himself. And it's kind of a dead giveaway because he has this very unsophisticated and actually foul vocabulary. But yeah, the thing is that Einar Jennings, he's contacted by Dougie Milford in Twin Peaks later on. Robert Jacoby's report on Einar Jennings is what kind of makes Dougie Milford catch wind of this. And Dougie knew Einar Jennings' son, Emil, from school. Dougie claims to have generally cautioned him in air quotes. But Tammy's under the impression that he in intimidated Einar Jennings to stay quiet. And given that, you know, Einar Jennings was the town drunk, it seemed like it was relatively easy, albeit still unethical. I think that's all we can say about the Jennings relation. Anything we should mention before we talk about more about Dougie and Twin Peaks?
Not on the Einar one, but that yes, he went to talk to him, and there was this one part where he said something like he said, I made a mental note in my book that in my mind that Einar's skin turned pale when he heard that there was, you know, danger afoot, because Dougie went there as a friend, not as an officer, and proposed it to him in a way to say, these other people were visited by high level scary people to get them to shut up, and people died. You know what I mean? Like, so I just remembered that was, again, it's part of Dougie's brain, I think, you know, how he calculates and also stores the data.
I think the only thing I can say about Einar before we move on to the next part about Dougie and Twin Peaks is that I think I have a less than terrible impression on how Dougie interacted with Einar. I kind of think that he just kind of cornered him at a bar when it was quiet. He's kind of a, you know, Einar, we can make your death look like an accident. And that was enough
Totally.
to keep him quiet.
Absolutely. 100%.
We were talking about before about like how we would keep people in silence, like, you know, kidnapping, may or may not be part of kidnapping Harold Dahl's son. But for him to go up to like a school friend's father, like it's not like, you know, there's more of a humanistic part where it's like someone who you've seen before. So I don't know. It's just that it's kind of like that was around the one, if it wasn't Harold Dahl's son, that was the weird part. The Einar Jennings one was where I was like, okay, this is like you're back at home and you know these people. It's
Right.
there has to be some ethics that he's dealing with.
Yeah, and I just think he's taking his mission very seriously. And who know, I mean, you know, again, he always through all of this has the has his own experience with the supernatural or aliens or whatever, you know, whatever it is that he saw in Pearl Lakes and in early in his life that is always in the back of his mind. And so it's like I feel like it's part of his driving force through the whole thing. It motivates him.
I'm glad that you mentioned Pearl Lakes because after he does talk with Einar, he actually feels compelled almost instantly to check Pearl Lakes for the first time in 20 years. And he says that his memories may or may not have been su suppressed unconsciously, and he felt they had no choice but to visit the site. Now, we were kind of beating around the bush, but you were alluding to potential sexual abuse that he faced when he was younger. But when
Yes.
it says, now that you bring that up, because I honestly, before this recording, I didn't even think about that. But when it says memories were suppressed unconsciously, I think that kind of fits in thematically with what you're saying. Because, you know, like, think of like Laura Palmer in Fire Walk With Me. Like the whole
Right.
idea is that she has those suppressed memories that like come flooding back. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, we probably won't have room to say too much more of it after this point. But should
Yeah.
we kind of talk more about the potential sexual abuse that Dougie endured or like what this, the visiting the site truly means to him?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if it does bring those memories back, then because right when he said I unconsciously from my Boy Scout days and with it came back memories of a strange experience I'd had 20 years earlier that I had unconsciously, I believe, long suppressed. So, I mean, there is the actual thing that is told in the book, which is the sighting of the giant and the owl, the big owl. And then there's the part that I just insinuated into it because of the Boy Scouts. I mean, I think it's rife with that possibility. That's what would create him to be so different than his brother and also have this compulsion. Whatever it is that's driving him.
One thing that will kind of I guess substantiate your claim about the sexual abuse is that, you know, admittedly, I think Major Briggs talks about seeing a giant owl at some point, but at the moreover, I want to mention that in The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, Laura talks about seeing a giant owl, I'm
Oh,
pretty
right.
sure. But you know, there's a whole thing about a giant owl in the woods, and you know, it's by Pearl Lake, so it's not like it could be close proximity, but I think at least there's some thematically tying into it if we're going with the idea that we're talking about like you know, sexual abuse or trauma that Dougie endured.
Right, and we'll never know because there's nothing else that really alludes to it in the book in a concrete way. I thought too, you know, they wanted to shut him up quickly. You know, he brings this thing up to them and they're not having it. They don't want to hear it, they don't want to talk about it. And not only that, but you're out.
I think that you know, now that we've talked about that part, it's good to talk about the more fantastical elements because once he does arrive to the site, day turns to black as night and he hears an electrical hum and he sees UFOs, the UFO lights and all ascend, but it stays below the tree line. And this is around the time when we have a young Carl Rodd, a young Margaret Coulson, and Alan Trahern looking up and disappearing with the UFO. There's no physical evidence left behind from this event. He does use his camera though. And Dougie realizes that he was near Owl Cave. It's a place they used to visit with his friends. Briggs and Tammy question his lack of evidence, and Dougie seems to have never shown pictures when he goes back to base. Do you think that this is another like kind of recurring theme of people not believing Dougie, or do you think this is a point where Briggs and Tammy might be right in that he might be an unreliable narrator?
That's a good question. Isn't there a thing too where, like, when you're taking pictures of ghosts or even Bigfoot, it doesn't show up on film? Like, isn't that a thing? Like, people don't get pictures of it. So, yeah, I know there's the unreliable narrator question. And so when you're dealing with fantastical stories like UFO sightings and owl sightings and everything, it's like, how reliable can the narrator be? You have to suspend disbelief in order to attached to the story in a way that you could believe it. So I don't know. It's a really good question. I'm not sure, but it's very real for him. I mean, but at the end of this section, he says he was seized by an extreme feeling of dread. Of course, he saw an abduction, right? And it was an abduction. I mean, that's so crazy. So he's had his own experience the first time, which he sees the owl and the giant, but it feels like there's something more to that story. And then now he has another one where he actually sees lights and a potential UFO, and then the kids disappear. And then there's just no evidence of it ever even being a thing. And that would mess a lot of people up.
Even though I generally seem to believe Dougie Milford up until this point, I think it's totally fine if people want to challenge the veracity of his statements, but I think it should be addressed that it is a young Margaret Lanerman and a young Carl Rob that were abducted. And Margaret very clearly was abducted, as she talked about in season two. So I think that part of the story can be very clearly substantiated, but also in the realm of the fantastic parts. And one of the reasons why I was talking about UFOs earlier on is that it talks about how this UFO, it stayed below the tree line. And I think it's alluding to, not extraterrestrial, but extra dimensional, that there's like this omnipresent type of entity. So I think that the fact that he explicitly said below the tree line, it was very much worth addressing about there. It just adds to the claim that there's something going on, and it alludes to the type of UFO that it is.
Right, for sure. And it does connect to the show because they had the branding. I mean, they did, and they disappeared.
We'll mention it later on, but Dougie does indeed have a marking on him. I believe it's like on his inner forearm or so. So I think again, it reaffirms the idea that he did indeed have this fantastical encounter.
Yes, absolutely. I don't get from Dougie that he's an unreliable narrator, not insofar as he's telling his own stories.
I just remember, I think it was when I did my Jack Parsons episode with David Bushman, is that he thinks that Dougie is an unreliable narrator. He's someone who understands Mark Frost very well, and I think he wouldn't say that just to say it. And it's just something I try to keep in mind that maybe there's times when Dougie can at least get hyperbolic, or it's like we were saying before, is that there's the potential implications that he's rubbing shoulders with General Twining and that he's kind of using that to his advantage. So
Yes.
again, I think that so far what we've seen, we can believe Dougie with like the at least the indirect evidence that's left behind, but because of his career and kind of how he's handling it, that you can challenge the veracity on some things as we go along.
Right. But this in particular, this story, I think too, again, he's not just explaining what happened, but he's expressing how he felt about it, which is very vulnerable. And especially as a man in his position, because he tells this story, right? And then they say his personal UFO experience went considerably beyond the other 17 entries on the Project Sign's initial list. And if he didn't want people to know what was going on, so I don't know, I kind of connect that to being an unreliable narrator. Why you give the story, but then why embellish it with how it made you feel? That's just something I thought of because that was sort of more of a modern day thing for people to express their feelings in the open sphere.
No, I think that, and again, we'll get to it when near the end, but that's when Dougie will truly open and be vulnerable about his life at large. But we are seeing those little moments, as you're saying, it's kind of chipping away where it's not a point at two, obviously, but there are those little signs that he will be more open as we go on. But to come back to his career, is that Project Sign soon becomes Project Grudge, and Dougie's line of work would change around this time. And a lot of this is, we should mention about Richard Nixon, who was not the president, but a congressman at this time. And he's writing to General Twining about a transcript that Nixon had with L. Ron Hubbard, who L. Ron Hubbard claimed to be a lieutenant, but he lies like a rug. But Richard Nixon doesn't know that. And
Right.
all this, it comes down to a secret recording that Hubbard had with Jack Parsons. And this would lead Jack Par or lead Dougie to go into Jack Parsons. Before we get into anything about Jack Parsons, though, I kind of had this thing when I started reading this, is that this whole transcript of General Twine and Nixon, I kind of wonder if Dougie was the transcriber. Like, maybe General Twining was the one because he was such close proximity that this is what led to Dougie getting the assignment for Jack. Do you agree with that, or do you think there's something else going on?
I think that's a possibility. That's an interesting thing. I hadn't thought of that before, but it's possible, right? I mean, it's the same thing with like when in reading the book, there's Milford and Briggs are together on this dossier and they're both contributing to it. But when you first read it and you don't know that. So I think that that is a really interesting thing to chew. I'm going to chew on that, Colin.
And again, like, because we were talking about before about questioning the veracity of Dougie at certain points, I don't think there's much to really question, at least on my end, when it comes to Jack Parsons, because, the way that Dougie enters his life is that he poses as a journalist sympathetic to Jack's work slash lifestyle. And it should be mentioned that Jack Parsons was wearing the Owl Cave ring at this time. I forget when Dougie Milford mentions it, but he does mention something about a ring during his encounters. Yeah, and again, it's just one of those things that's like so explicitly centric to the Twin Peaks mythos that, it's like, why would Dougie lie about this? Like, there's no reason why he would doctor this or falsify this. But yeah, it's I think we should also mention is that Dougie hears all about Hubbard, and there's the implied magic ritual that Parsons worked on with him. Then also there's gray aliens are mentioned, like the Zeta Reticulans, and Dougie, and this is according to Tammy, he misses Parsons' reference to Sirius, not the word Sirius, but Sirius, Sirius, which is another alien race. Yeah, and actually I do think that it's like what I was mentioned earlier about White Sands, New Mexico, is that do you think that now that we're talking about Parsons and Dougie Milford, that there is some connection to White Sands relative to this interaction now?
Possibly, but I think, one of the, I mean, look. I love that Parsons is intertwined in this. I mean, he was working on the technology, he developed the technology that was rockets and bombs. It's all intertwined, right? I mean, they couldn't have done it as quickly, or who knows if they even would have done it without Parsons' contribution at the time. So I think Dougie is either sent or to go see Parsons, or he has his own, that at some point it says he's very good at sniffing out cases. So he decides to go see him. But he gets through this whole thing, and at the end of the conversation, his recommendation is to take away his security clearance. And that was ostensibly the end of his career. So, I mean, that's a very powerful thing. Jack Parsons was 30 something, right? So he basically goes to do this and then makes a recommendation like he's got to go. So I that's what I mean, I kind of took away from that. As far as I can't remember what was the question that you asked initially.
Actually, the correlation of White Sands, because I should mention is that it's Jack Parson points out to Dougie that White Sands means journey of a dead man. And once again, this opens the doors to part eight and how it may or may not tie into both these men's lives. So, and I like I know, like I said, I know that can lead to a major rabbit hole, but I just have a hard time overlooking that this would be anything other than extremely important to at least part eight in the return.
For sure, because again, there's the thing about nuclear weapon, right? The nuclear explosion being the thing that irreparably changes the whole universe, right? I mean, and that it the bomb is the ripping open of a tear in the fabric so that this evil can come in. And that's where I see the connection, is that Trinity and Parsons and all, they're all crescendoing up to this thing that just irreparably and you can never turn it back what happened with the development of the nuclear bomb. Because a lot of the in the book, I think it's in Messengers too as well, about how there's a lot of UFO sightings around nuclear plants. And of course, I think we may have, back in w around the Maury Island incident, there's that beautiful picture of the Hanford nuclear plant, which is in Washington. And so there's a deep history of that plant in Washington. The land, I'm going to maybe get this kind of messed up, but the land was part of the Nez Perce deal, I think. They got the land, right? And then the US government comes in when they want to start producing nuclear energy. And nuclear, whatever, the stuff for nuclear bombs, and they claim eminent domain. So they kick the native people off, they build that huge plant, and now they're just polluting the earth in an absolutely, again, an irreparable way. And so that's why, again, I think it is all intertwined. Episode 8 is the connection here. But Mark Frost is he's an environmental guy. I mean, there's so much about the environment, right? So that's why. I mean, I think yes, the answer is yes, Colin. I think there is a direct connection between Jack Parsons, JPL, Washington, White Sands, and Milford as a representative of Twin Peaks.
No, I agree. I think for me, where I stand is that with White Sands and being relative to Journey of a Dead Man, I think of in part eight when we get to the Black and White segment, you see that nuclear bomb go off, and I think of how integral fire is to a nefarious degree in all of Twin Peaks, specifically when Lynch uses it. Because I bring this in my episodes that if fire in a fireplace can kind of, in my opinion, kind of like change people in terms of how they can kind of dictate their actions in certain scenes, I think when it comes to a nuclear bomb, this is like almost like a true evil that that irreparably damages the world. This is when we get the Bob Orb coming down, and then there's I'll refer to it as the experiment, but people allude to the entity as possibly being Judy. So this is like all sorts of evil is being summoned because of this.
Totally.
Of course, there's unknowingly that we have the firemen and Senator Odito with Laura Palmer, the Golden Orb. So there is at least that, but. When we're focused on the nuclear bomb, it's all just an absolute chaotic nature. It summons like a true evil. With Bob, we talk about at that point, decades later with Leland Palmer, where it's like what he does is like a true evil in terms of what he does to Laura. I think that unfortunately, there's, I don't want to dive too much further into part eight because I know that can just be an endless rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But,
Yeah.
I guess to end this segment with Dougie's first encounter with Jack Parsons, that Jack leaves as his wife arrives and is unable to, elaborate working on Babylon. Dougie does not leave the site though, because he does, with the name redacted, meet a former colleague of Jack Parsons who is from the Suicide Squad. And I guess for anyone who may or may not have missed out on my Jack Parsons episode, Suicide Squad was this kind of team, almost like a skeleton crew that Jack Parsons had of like testing explosives, kind of like in a very experimental manner in his early years. So, it's someone who knew Jack Parsons for quite some time at that point. So I think that's very important to put out there. So Dougie tells this colleague, or former colleague rather, that he's on a military assignment, and he will promise anonymity for his help, which Dougie Milford does admittedly honor. They both go to Arroyo Seco, where Jet Propulsion Laboratory did a lot of its training. Dougie would learn from this colleague about Hell's Gate at Arroyo Seco, that Parsons was trying to open up a gate, I think relative to the Thelema rituals, the goddess Babylon being the mother of abominations. And both this redacted person and Dougie Milford question why Parsons would provoke the end of the world. And with this comes back to full circle about the journey of a dead man in White Sands, New Mexico. So yeah, I know that there's a lot to sink in, and we're kind of digging up everything from part eight again, but is there anything we should keep in mind with this encounter?
Well, it's not the last time that they're going to see each other. That's one, I guess. And for Milford to be learning about the Thelema rituals and the working of Babylon, which is like, again, even not even taking part eight into account, but just going down that path of Parsons and Hubbard and their relationship. Oh my goodness, Colin, it is endlessly fascinating thing to me. And so, yeah, I don't know that there's anything more pertinent that needs to be said right now, but for anyone who is interested in learning more about that relationship and the Babylon working, do you know about the book by Peter Gray, Colin? Do you know? So the book is called The Two Antichrists, and it is the story of Hubbard and Parsons becoming friends and then doing this ritual together and then what happened. And Peter Gray is an author and also a publisher. He has a publishing company, which I can't remember the name of, and it's not in the United States, but it's a very heady book. It's not an easy read, but it's deeply fascinating, and I highly recommend it to go down that rabbit hole.
I guess we can kind of like gloss over a tiny bit because, at least from the implications of this, what Dougie wrote, that he was brought up to speed with what Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard was doing. Because I believe it was a sex magic ritual where I think L. Ron Hubbard was reading like from a transcript of sorts, like an ancient, almost like ancient, some sort of ancient saying. And Parsons, I mean, he was masturbating and was ejaculating on a tablet. Like I know that gets a lot of laughs from people when I explain it, but that's what happened. Like
No,
there's no
right. Well,
way around
because
it.
there's the whole, I mean, again, this is like deep, deep shit, but Aleister Crowley had this system, and that by having an orgasm at the point at which you are really consuming this information, those two things allow them to imbue in your being or something like that, right? That there was an actual purpose to the person conducting the ritual to masturbate. And so he would do it, and Hubbard would write, and then Hubbard would do it, and Parsons would write. I mean, they went back and forth. They didn't get the Moonchild, but they ended up with oh my goodness, what was Parsons' wife's
Oh yeah, it's
name?
actually the reason why I was bringing this up is that when they're trying to summon the Moonchild, certainly Parsons goes home and then he finds Marjorie Cameron,
Right.
and he speculates that he may or may not have summoned her. So and actually the reason why this ties back is that Dougie Milford realizes that's the same woman from before when Jack Parsons left not that long ago. So yeah, so he does see this woman who may or may not have been this accidental byproduct of trying to summon the Moonchild.
Right, because that's what it was, is that you're trying to get the elemental. And so, it always conjures up Diane to me in the red wig, because when you see the pictures of the elemental in occult materials, that's what she looks like. She's a redhead. It's Babylon. So it's, isn't it? It's fascinating stuff. It's so crazy that this ties back to Twin Peaks.
But I think the other thing that makes this even crazier is that Dougie also has this realization that this ritual between Parsons and Hubbard may or may not have happened before the UFO incident. Specifically, I think Roswell, I believe. But I don't know, do you think there's something like, and I'm saying this in like a real life sense, not just a Mark Frost secret history sense. Would you say that this ritual would have set off UFOs or unidentified objects in those subsequent weeks? Or do you think this was like happened to be a coincidence?
Yeah, I mean, okay. So then you first, I would go more towards it being a coincidence, but the story being told again is that through the ritual, there was a tear in the fabric of the universe through that ritual. I mean, they were summoning an otherworldly event to happen, and that as a result, I know that's what it's implying, as a result of the Babylon working, UFOs were able to come in, right? So I don't, I'm not sure. It's an interesting question to get asked. What do you believe? I mean, I guess if I put myself in the story mindset, I'm more inclined to believe that the nuclear bomb is what would have done it than the Babylon working, because you also have to believe in magic. And I don't know, I'm not a spiritual person, so I don't know if I'm agnostic. Do you believe it? What do you think? Coincidence or truth?
I think it's closer to what you believe because, like what I was saying before, and admittedly, this has come through the lens of part eight, but, if we're to believe that, the nuclear bomb is what would prompt the Bob Orb to come, and then the experiment, which may or may not be tied to Judy, would descend down to it, this event would actually lead to all this evil being unleashed in the world. And I do kind of wonder if there is some about like nuclear warfare from that point on, because we're not just talking, and this is going beyond Twin Peaks, this is just going the real world, but you think about how, like during the Cold War in the 50s, like there was this fear that you could just end all of humanity 20 times over with like a handful of missiles.
At that point, so I just found this one thing, Colin. Aaron Cohen gave me this book a while back called The Critical Essays on Twin Peaks. And this one is by Elizabeth Lowry. And I just thought this was so fascinating when I was doing my research. She says, in the Twin Peaks universe, a discursive triangulation between extraterrestrials, nuclear power, and evil manifests in the figure of Bob, written in capital letters. Written in capital letters is the Twin Peaks script's BOB, which recalls a Cold War era acronym for Bolt Out of the Blue, meaning a surprise nuclear attack. Had you ever heard that Bob was an acronym? I had never heard. I thought, oh my God, that's he's he you know so there's this view too that he's directly connected. And of course, when the experiment spits him out during that time, it's all connected to White Sands, right? I mean, it's at least in part eight, the bomb does the bomb occur first before he spits out?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, the bomb definitely occurs first. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that it's all connected.
To come back to Jack Parsons, L. Ron Hubbard, I think they were just like a byproduct of the evil of White Sands. That they had their own thing going, but even the Moonchild, they didn't quite summon the Moonchild. It was something that was maybe a byproduct of something nefarious, but Marjorie Cameron was clearly not the Moonchild. At least from what my research.
And you know, Parsons was doing his own thing, and it didn't have anything to do with extraterrestrials or even what's the other word we're calling them? Not.
Oh yeah, there was Zeta Reticulans and then Sirius. At least that's what was listed in that conversation.
So, you know, occult magic was its own thing for its own purpose. And so they just happen, they intersect because of the technology, right? I mean, the fact that Parsons was into this weird out there stuff, but was also one of the masterminds of the modern day missile. You know what I mean? Like his story intersects with Twin Peaks and Milford because of the technology. That's what I think ultimately.
You mentioned earlier is that Dougie, even though he does seem to sympathize with Jack, this interaction and specifically what this anonymous person from the Suicide Squad said to him is that this is what pushes Dougie to deny Jack Parsons of his security clearance. In June of 1952, Dougie visits Jack once again, and he notices that he's still wearing the Owl Cave ring, that Jack seems more decrepit, that he's working on pyrotechnics for the film industry. Also notices hypodermic needles, sci-fi magazines, some symbols relating to Thelema, maybe most importantly, a painted black devil head. The conversation's short-lived. Jack returns to his work. What I should mention is that in real life, Jack Parsons, apparently there was speculation by the government that he was going to Mexico, moving there with his wife to possibly sell some like intel relating to warfare to Israel. Dougie assesses that Jack is a high security risk because he's moving out of the country. And this is when Jack is quote unquote killed in an explosion 2 days later. That Major Briggs implies that a bomb was probably planted under the floorboards and it detonated.
Yeah, so that's a conspiracy theory that he was murdered, right? I mean, that's why Milford gets sent to go see him, right? Who sends him to go see him? I guess it's Nixon, right? It says after the report, the House Un-American Committee planted a bullseye on Jack Parsons. So he gets a directive, you know, so I mean, years go by and then he goes to see him again or however much time goes by because he wants to suss out if he's going to be selling secrets to a foreign government, right? I mean, that's why he goes. And so I mean, what's the implication? Either Milford killed him, which I don't think happened. Milford doesn't seem like an assassin to me. Or they're saying his wife did it, or the government did it. I don't know. There's a lot of possible perpetrators. I don't know. Do you think he was murdered?
You know, I remember me and David Bushman talk about when we did the Jack Parsons episode. I over time, I don't know if I quite agreed with it with David Bushman at the time, but as time went on, David Bushman was talking about you know, like deaths with certain people. You know, everyone's like, oh, he was so careful. Like he always made sure everything was in proper order to come to Jack Parsons is that this place was in absolute disarray. Like to show how bad it was, is that when Jack Parsons had the explosion, his roommates upstairs tried to paint over the black devil head. So this was all completely just like a like total shock to everyone. I don't like to go with the whole like it happened to be at the right time, but I do think that and I know you said it was mentioned as a conspiracy theory, but I think the only thing that really challenges it is that Major Briggs talks about that there's something under the floorboards. And with Major Briggs, I think he's very intuitive, but also we see that he makes a lot of mistakes, which may
Right.
or may not be there deliberately. But I just want to mention is that at least with Major Briggs, I think there's at least something to discuss about why he thinks that there's an explosion that set it off.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things that just gets dropped in like a turd, and then you have to decide what you're going to do with it. I mean, there was a lot of speculation at the time. It wasn't in the, when you go back to look at the historical text around Jack Parsons' life and the end of his life, there was a lot of speculation about how he died because of the fact that he had handled that material so many times and knew the explosiveness of it. And to have some just fumble and drop it just did seem out of character for him. But you know what? He was also on a lot of drugs. I mean, they were high all the time, speed and heroin and whatever it is that they were doing all the time. So there are some things I think that are kind of fun to think about. And that one, I think it just was probably a terrible accident.
I'm sometimes shaky on that. The only other one I can shift to at times is that when Dougie said he was a threat to, you know, for Clarence, that maybe he would just be taken in and put on trial, but it was someone else in the government that pushed for Jack Parsons to be not just taken in, but killed. So
Right.
I do agree with you. I don't think Dougie would be the assassin type. He's the type that would silence someone. And I
Right.
think that, you know, going with the idea that someone from the government just killed Jack Parsons and like some that's planted. It, but still, there's a whole thing of like, Jack Parsons being so disheveled at that point that it's like, it's very ambiguous.
Yeah, I mean, because there was also he had done that. One of the theories was that he sat as an expert witness in a case against a police officer, and that was that famous picture where he had the thing in his hand with the wick and the explosive, and that they found it in the car. And that officer, I guess, went to jail. And so that was another conspiracy theory that the police were somehow involved. That it was just the timing. I mean, obviously, Milford is made up, so there's not really like the timing around the Milford visit. But for the purpose of the book, there's a wanting from the book for us to think of this in terms of what would be possible, but I still think it was just a mistake, an error. He had an accident, which is really a shame because I mean he was really young and he was such a smart person.
No, but yeah, it's like what we were saying is that you look at some of those pictures of Jack Parsons from his latter days, and he really didn't look good at all. Like he
No.
dressed well enough, all things considered, but he was so disheveled that it's not a far cry to think that he would, because I think what was it, like someone was in a coffee can, so this is clearly not a professional environment.
Yeah, no, he was in his garage, right? And I mean, he also probably wasn't taking it totally serious either because he was doing it for the movie business and he probably thought that was just so stupid. I mean, he was sending rockets into outer space and now he's like crashing cars for special effects. You know what I mean? It's so I think who knows what was in his mind, but it was a shame for sure.
To come back to Dougie Milford's career is that we were talking about his role in Project Grudge, but this would actually lead into Project Blue Book, which Dougie Milford would be at this first meeting. Briggs writes about there's 17 years worth of field work, and it's an answer that no one wanted to hear. It would be a go to investigate dozens of UFO sightings. There's a 1958 journal entry, and it implies that Dougie has a high placed source in the White House at this time. It's codename M, but I'm not sure if it's Tammy or Briggs, but someone does actually confirm that it is indeed Richard Nixon and that Milhouse was the middle name. I guess also we should mention around this time is that I noticed this in the final dossier upon reading it earlier today. I'm thinking about the redacted names that are, listed throughout Project Blue Book, but one of the redacted names seems like it was confirmed by Tammy in the final dossier that Wyndham Earle was here. Because in season two, Wyndham Earle is working on Project Blue Book, and he just absolutely loses his mind, or at least seems to lose his mind as presented. I was actually thinking about is that could you imagine Dougie Milford and Wyndham Earle having to have a conversation at morning coffee? Just the most
No.
darkly bizarre humor that would emanate from those two.
It would have been very odd, I'm sure. Really weird. I mean, Wyndham was hard to even see him having any sort of a normal conversation.
Because they come from like two different worlds. Because Wyndham Earle is like a genius right out of the gate, as Cooper says in season two, he has a mind as sharp as a diamond. And here we have Dougie Milford, where he's like the most unprofessional professional person in the government. Where it's like he ascended pretty high quickly in the military. But if I'm going with what I said about General Nathan Twining, that would indicate that he's just rubbing shoulders with the right people and is using what he knew from Roswell to get to that point. But yeah, then that's not even going with the fact that Wyndham Earle was just like. It seemed like Project Blue Book was like the biggest change of emotion happened. So Dougie would have, in theory, been there for to see some of that, or at least to hear about it indirectly while working for Project Blue Book. But yeah, I think also we should mention is that come back to the 1958 journal entry, and this is going to be lead into President Nixon being a prominent part throughout like a portion of the secret history. M, as he is referred to at the time, he refers to a shadow government, Freemasons running it, Eisenhower actively working on UFOs, possibly even with UFOs. Now, if anything, if Watergate is anything to go by, Richard Nixon is just a very paranoid person. And man, that was like something much smaller compared to Freemasonry and UFOs. So,
Yeah.
and I guess this would be more so in the realm of Twin Peaks rather than real life history, but do you think Richard Nixon was justified to be as paranoid as he was, or do you think that his paranoia is the thing that basically ruined him?
I think it would be impossible for me to know if his paranoia was justified. Certainly, there are so many levels in government. And here, they mention at one point in here about when Blue Book is formed about Majestic 12, which there's very little you can find out about the Majestic 12. And so that's sort of like, I don't know, a shadow government, or they're like the, like Bobsey said, when you'd say they, Majestic 12 is the them. They're the they do this. It's them, like so it's high level spooky stuff. You have to, I think, buy into the fact that if you think Nixon's paranoia was justified, it's because there's all kinds of crazy shadowy stuff in a conspiratorial way going on. But like this entry here from Milford is describing the thing called the Treaty of Grajeda. Do you know about this? The Treaty of Grajeda. So Eisenhower goes on vacation and then disappears for like 40 hours. And you can read about this, right? And he just disappears and he goes, there's no record of where he goes. Like the president, every move is recorded by time in a log somewhere. And so there was no recording of it. And then his team comes out and says, oh, he had a tooth problem and he had to have emergency tooth surgery, which is probably true. But the UFO conspiracy people have this story that he gets taken to Holman incident at Holman Air Force Base in New Mexico, right? So that he goes to meet, and like the aliens want to meet with Eisenhower. So the first aliens that want to meet with him are the Nordics, right? So that's the giants. And they say, we want to make a deal with you that you will not do anything bad and you will stop using nuclear weapons. It says the Ike rejected the offer. The Nordic types apparently made their offer contingent on the US giving up their nukes. So that group of aliens is like, don't use nuclear weapons anymore. We just all want to love each other. And Eisenhower says, buzz off. And then the Greys come up and they're like, well, we'll in exchange for tech and stuff, you let us abduct some human beings and create experiments on them. And they're like, okay. And so that's the treaty that they made. There are movies about it. I mean, it's a huge conspiracy theory about the Treaty of Grajeda. You should look it up sometime, but that's what this is referring to, this event.
You mentioned the Majestic 12 earlier, and you're right. Because I remember when I was writing notes for this, I wrote down that President Truman's Majestic 12 was disbanded as Project Blue Book was starting to take off. But there wasn't much else before or after that. It was just stuff that
Right.
President Truman did. And even President Truman's not really, of all the presidents that we see of like mid 20th century, he's like probably the least mentioned out of all of them at this point.
Yes, agreed.
So I think there is something to be said about how shadowy he is, that even with Major Briggs and Dougie Milford and Tammy Preston going through this dossier, that there's so little to follow up with Truman when all three of them can elaborate so much more on all the other subsequent presidents.
Right, agreed, agreed.
Now it's also a good time to start talking about Dougie and his ascendance again in his career and his relationship with Nixon, because
Yes.
Briggs talks about how Dougie was actually an excellent officer in Project Blue Book. And he was ranked as lieutenant colonel by 1966. Now, I know that he had a quite an ascendance throughout the 40s, but this is a big deal. Like for him to be such a high position for Project Blue Book, that says something. And that's not even going the fact that he becomes, I would say, even a friend of Nixon. And I should mention though, is that the first time, at least what we have reported here in the dossier, is that Dougie has a basically a transcript with President Nixon about UFO report on February 24th, 1969. Now, put aside that this is barely a month after Nixon's inauguration, is there anything we should talk about the date being February 24th and what it means to Twin Peaks in general?
Yeah, it's very significant, right? I don't know. Obviously, nothing seems unintentional in any of the material other than the fact that it's acknowledging that it's February 24th. It's an eight, right? Two, and so two is February, and two is four, and four is eight. And I mean, I always come back to eights in Twin Peaks because it seems apropos. But other than that, I mean, I just think it's a nice callback, just like in the final dossier, all the files end with 119. Do you think there's more significance to it?
There's that part of me where I can't quite elaborate on it, and I feel like while I do feel like I'm reading too far into it, apart from the obvious of the day Laura Palmer is found and also murdered earlier that morning, there is, I forget when it is, but it's early 20th century. It's in the Twin Peaks Gazette when they talk about this like major forest fire that occurred. And I kind of wonder is that, those two events are clearly pivotal to Twin Peaks in one form or another. And this one, because there is stuff to be said about the trajectory of Richard Nixon's career and Dougie Milford, but at the same time, I don't know if I can tie it back to the Twin Peak, the town of Twin Peaks in general. So I do have to put a pin in it, and it probably won't come to me for like months, if not years. But
You
I
might
do
find
think
something.
that, yeah, so if it's not a red herring, it's at least something about the long-term ramifications of what Nixon and Dougie talk about. And I guess, we should probably bring up the more, the substantive part of this report is that Nixon is, to put it mildly, very unhappy about General Condon dismantling Project Blue Book, and this hinders Dougie's work. Dougie, when asked, he elaborates on how there are not only extraterrestrial but extra-dimensional life out there.
So fascinating. Yeah.
And Tanny says this is the first time she's heard that term mentioned of extra-dimensional. And then Nixon and Dougie, they talk about Air Force Directive 200-2. This prohibits information on UFOs going public unless it's significantly and scientifically proven. Dougie, he also elaborates on the logistics of global UFO sightings. And Nixon does press him a little further on this. With Project Blue Book being dismantled, I'm trying to think if we're, I know we're coming back to the significance of this conversation. I think by this point, Wyndham Earle would have been off it. No, I guess the only thing I can really elaborate on is that this is what would lead to Dougie Milford coming back to Twin Peaks. And it is a week after the moon landing. I do want to actually acknowledge, though, is that when it says the moon landing, I think of an earlier in the secret history. It's when Norma writes a letter to, or a postcard rather, her and Hank write a postcard to, I believe it's her mother and what they're doing on their honeymoon. But the date of this postcard, it's
It's
April of
wrong,
19. I believe it's
right?
April when the moon landing was
Yeah, the
like at
stamp
least
has the
4
wrong
months
date.
later. Yeah, it's 3 or 4 months later.
Mm-hmm.
So when it says the moon landing, do you kind of follow with the Norma Jennings postcard, or do you just think of the traditional actual date of the moon landing?
I think of the actual date of the moon landing myself. I mean, I that whole thing with the postcard was very interesting, and it obviously was an intentional lead into something else, but I stick with the truth. I stick with the story that I believe.
Oh no, I was gonna say is that I stick with the actual because I think it's I should know this offhand, but I believe it's July of that year that the moon landing occurs.
Yeah, I don't remember the date, but
Yeah, the stamp is like I think it's made out of material that was from the moon. So again, that's why I felt like even though I think that I stick with the traditional date, I felt like I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the postcard that Norma Jennings wrote and why this of all things may or may not be falsified because. How do you explain like an earlier date about something relative to the moon landing?
Right. Exactly.
So Dougie, he does return to Twin Peaks and he tells everyone that he's retiring. This is actually going to open up a, like two logistical problems because this is the first reported death of Robert Jacoby that it's, Major Briggs just writes almost unceremoniously that he died in 1969. And we have a whole thing at the end with a funeral card and everything that he died in the mid 80s. And also, is that the reason why I bring up Robert Jacoby's death in addition to that is that this is what leads to Dougie taking over the Twin Peaks Gazette and actually also later on change it to the Twin Peaks Post. And the reason why there's a bit of a caveat to this is that in the access guide of the town, it is listed that Dougie was the as the founder and publisher of the Twin Peaks
Oh,
Gazette.
so that's totally different.
Oh yeah. And now I guess for me, I kind of when I look at the access guide, I do like going through it for the sake of this research, but I think that with the access guide, I feel like it's easy to dismiss because I kind of have this thing in my head that basically the access guide is this thing that was like kind of like thrown around by the Chamber of Commerce to try and make Twin Peaks look presentable.
Yes, and you don't know who put it in. Right, exactly. Could have been put together by people who didn't even have the dates.
The reason why it's easy for me to dismiss certain facts in the access guide is that there's that weird window frame because it's dedicated to Andrew Packard, where he has like a it has a date of year and a date of death, but then it has a colon and that has another year to imply he's still alive. And then there's all these things about Andrew Packard. It's kind of hard to pin down when this would be written. There's dates in 1991, so I stick with the idea that this thing was written shortly after Andrew Packard reemerged, and then they just kind of left it hover around for 2 years. So.
Yeah, that's a good theory.
I believe the Dougie Milford being the founder of the Twin Peaks Gazette is kind of like apocryphal. That's like, no, that didn't happen. That's just some to just kind of fill up space in the access
I
guide.
like that. Agreed. Totally agree.
Coming back to the relationship between Dougie and Richard Nixon is that they have little contact throughout Nixon's first term as president. Briggs actually speculates that Dougie was quietly assembling a team at this time.
So Blue Rose Task Force? I mean, is I that's what I put. What do
No,
you
that's a
think?
really good point. I kind of thought it was almost like this kind of like fringe group of sorts, because I'm thinking about how paranoid Richard Nixon was. But at some point, I don't know if it's around this time, but at some point, Nixon does end up being in contact with Goran Cole, and like that would probably be the thing that would prompt the Blue Rose Task Force. And
Right. And I think there's a later, there's another point at which I think Nixon says, bring a team together, put a team together. And that was really when I was like, okay, that's the Blue Rose Task Force. I don't know about that because this one seems a little early for that.
it could be argued this is kind of like the early days of like not it's not the Blue Rose Task Force, but it's like the fundamentals that would be built off once it got to Goran Cole. So,
Yes, exactly. It's the no name. It's the no name task force at that point.
but like I said, that Nixon and Dougie, there's a lot of speculation of what they were and were not doing relative to UFOs. But come Richard Nixon's second term, that Dougie is summoned to Key Biscayne, Florida, on February 12th of 1973. He arrives to Nixon's private office, where Nixon, and at least if we're going to believe what Tammy says at the end of this segment, it's Jackie Gleason, whose name is redacted throughout all this, is that they're in golf attire after a charity event. Dougie realizes that this is Nixon's private library on UFOs, as they're also talking about Jackie's UFO-shaped library room. Dougie evades Jackie's question about informing the public about UFOs, which actually pleases Nixon because it shows that there's a loyalty to Nixon and
Yes.
keeping UFOs secretive. But Dougie does say he thinks Americans have the right to know, which I think certainly Nixon and Jackie Gleason don't really have any opposition. Before we get to the main reason why he goes to Fort Biscayne, anything we should mention about the dynamics between Nixon, Jackie Gleason, and Dougie Milford?
Well, to me, it was like, so, Milford gets to go on this very unique thing, this very unique trip, right? To leave Twin Peaks and go to Florida to meet with the president of the United States at his private place with Jackie Gleason, right? So there's a lot of trust in Nixon into Dougie, right? Because he invites him on this very highly secret mission that they're on. So I think it just really punctuates how Nixon feels about Milford. And yeah, and that's really the main thing that I got out of this. I mean, and also the things that you mentioned, though, about wanting it to be public, I think, they're always pushing against those forces, right? So it's the goodies and the baddies, the Masons and the Illuminati. They're always sort of in the shadows, as the book kind of represents, They also have to play it safe too, but I liked the idea that the book conveyed that Dougie really thinks that the information should be public, that it shouldn't be kept. And that goes back to the theme of the book, which is mysteries and secrets, right? That mystery is good and secret sucks. And you keep these secrets, and all it does is foment distrust and disconnection and just like what we see in our modern world. So I think that part of the conversation again like amplifies that concept of secrets versus mysteries.
And of course, I'll say this as we explain their where they go to, but I think that the whole thing about secrets really starts to kick in because that Nixon, he calls for a car to visit the Homestead Air Force Base, and Dougie recognizes a general at the door. The name's redacted in the actual text, but Dougie seems to have met him previously, and he thinks that said general is affiliated with the Majestic 12. So, we were talking about the most. Even with a
Right.
secret history, this is a very secret society. So,
Yes.
so it shows like how truly secretive this vicinity that they're in and what they're about to see. Dougie starts to notice that Nixon and Jackie are visibly nervous, and they walk past remnants of a UFO, and this one is triangular and not circular. And then Dougie can't confirm it to Jackie if it's authentic. Actually, I guess because we should also talk about before we get to the main event. Do you think there's any distinction between the circular UFOs and the triangular UFOs?
Only that, again, I think the US government, in the world of conspiracies that I've gone down many of these tunnels to, have these underground places where they manufacture different tech and have meetings in these underground military bases. And so that a triangular plane or triangular ship or whatever you're going to call it, to me, makes me think more of the actual aircraft that we know the US government has, right? Those, I don't know what you call them, but there's like those fighter jets that are triangles, right? So that it just keeps the question in the mind of whether we're seeing UFOs that are extraterrestrial or it's the US government and foreign governments testing their shit out. in the air. You know what I mean? I mean, that's what it makes me think of.
I think for me, there's two things that I think of because this actually applies to not Mark Frost, Secret Street, but like stuff that I've heard in the real world. The first one, in terms of chronological order, it was in 1997. There's someone who called Art Bell, and he wanted to spill secrets about like major populations being wiped out by these extraterrestrial and/or extra-dimensional forces. But what he says, this person sounds very panicked, and they say that they will soon triangulate his position. So when I reread this and saw the triangular UFO, it just made me think of that.
Online, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Yes.
Hi. I don't have a whole lot of time.
Well, look, let's begin by finding out whether you're using this line properly or not.
Area 51.
Yeah, that's right. Were you an employee or are you now?
A former employee.
Former employee.
I was let go on a medical discharge about a week ago, and I've kind of been running across the country. Oh man, I don't know where to start. They're gonna they'll triangulate on this position really, really soon.
So you can't spend a lot of time on the phone. So give us something quick.
Okay. Okay. What we're thinking of as aliens are they're extra dimensional beings that an earlier precursor of the space program made contact with. They are not what they claim to be. They have infiltrated a lot of aspects of the military establishment, particularly the Area 51. The disasters that are coming, the military. I'm sorry, the government knows about them, and there's a lot of safe areas in this world that they could begin moving the population to now, Art.
But they're not doing
They
anything.
are not. They want the major population centers wiped out so that the few that are left will be more easily controllable.
Discharged.
I started getting.
In some way, something knocked us off the air, and we're on a backup system now.
It's the government, or.
I don't know.
It has to be something, though.
Well, did you hear? Now, you tell me because you were listening.
That was awful strange.
There was a really weird guy on the air when it went off?
Yeah, real weird out.
Like going sort of sounding paranoid,
yeah,
schizophrenic.
like crying and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how far into the conversation was it when it went off?
Just a couple, about 15, 20 seconds, I'd say.
Oh,
Something like
you guys missed, you really missed the call then, and I've got a feeling somebody didn't want you to hear it.
And then if we're going with a more recent one, I believe it was in 2018 or 2019, but Terry Crews, of all people, posted on Instagram of like these lights they saw hovering over like Los Angeles, and they were what seemed to be in a triangular position. Maybe I'm misremembering, but I have seen like, no, there's been footage of like lights that people don't know what they are. Like it's like clearly people are like drawing attention to it. So, it's just like these two stories that, obviously I don't have anything concrete to be like, yes, this happened, or yes, this thing in Art Bell clearly was not staged. Like, it's not a matter of like whether I believe or not. It's more so rather that this is stuff that clearly Mark Frost is modeling after, or at least that's what I
Yes.
got from it.
Oh, I agree completely.
We're actually veering away from UFOs, and now we're getting into like some form of aliens. And again, we can debate on what type they are, but I should mention is that the general, whose name is redacted, shows them a small entity through a one-way glass. It has oval eyes, gray-green skin, and it could also disappear. Dougie, in particular, felt that he could pass out at any moment and also felt nauseous. This so it upset Jackie Gleason, Richard, I don't know if Richard Nixon, but Dougie also, that they just rode back in silence back to Fort Biscayne. Nixon told Dougie that they'd stay in touch but would never see each other in person again. Dougie has no idea what Nixon's motive was to show him and Jackie Gleason. And Dougie never talked about it, and he thinks Jackie didn't either. Before we go too much further, Do you have any thoughts about like this alien or how they reacted to it?
Well, of course, it makes me think of the box, right? The glass box immediately as soon as I have that picture in my brain. And then the being or creature that shows up in the box being in that amorphous kind of state with a similar shape. But this is one of those areas where Dougie starts to talk about less about what he sees and more about what he feels. Like he's kind of an empath in a way, which you wouldn't maybe connect to him because he's also has to be very detached in certain ways with his job. If he has to threaten people and shut people up and do stuff that might not really, it's not that it's not part of his nature, but he's both. He's good and bad. He's got it all going on at the same time, right? He's the Black Lodge and the White Lodge all inside of one person. And so in this section where they're seeing it, that's what he sees. So I think of the box and the glass box with the kids watching it, that makes me connect back to that. And then also why Nixon chooses to show him this right now. I don't know if Nixon saw that hit, the end was nigh for him, but maybe he just really felt like if he didn't make this known to someone, and the one person he trusted was Doug, that he would never be able to pursue it further once he's out of office.
For me to start off, and I'll talk about like the real world history, is that, through the lens of early 1969, is that despite the fact that Richard Nixon won that presidency by a landslide, like it was never even to come close, that his paranoia was off the charts, that people would turn against him. So I think this date does align in that regard, that, he should be feeling good that he has a second term, but also, he's bringing Jackie Gleason, who he's friends with. He summons Dougie Milford, like from Twin Peaks, like, going from Washington State to Florida, that is a long trip. So clearly this was like something very important to Nixon. I think for his motive, I think he just wanted people to know that, this thing that he's like built his like life obsession around, because, at Fort Biscayne, there was like a library, just all things UFOs.
Right.
And Richard Nixon, I think he says it to Jackie that he doesn't want the public to know about his obsession with UFOs. And again, it comes back to the whole paranoia thing.
Right, because he thinks people will think he's crazy, which he was. I mean, for sure, he had his stuff. But yeah, I agree with you on that. I mean, I guess the thing too is as president, you get the higher level you get up in your security clearance, the more information you're allowed to see too. So it, who knows at what point in Nixon's career as president, he was actually privy to this information and creature. It's so interesting.
Yeah, the other one I want to mention, this will tie into Jackie Gleason, is that there's a number that's scribbled in at the end of this report. It's 295-3784. Tammy, decades later, would trace this and find out that it was actually Jackie Gleason's phone line from that time. But I do want to mention is that I forget if, because he was soon to be divorced to his wife at that time. And apparently, when he came home that night, he was like sweating and he was like freaking out about something he saw. I don't know if he explicitly said UFOs, but he was clearly visibly shaken. And I forget, I've heard two stories. I heard it was either an issue from Esquire that was pulled the instant this got out. And I also heard it was in his wife's memoir that was almost published. But she does, apparently she brought this up and like it was redacted, like, one of the other was redacted on those grounds. So,
Yeah, I heard both of those stories as well.
because yeah, when Dougie says that he thinks Jackie Gleason didn't talk about it, I'm not gonna throw this on Dougie that he's like an unreliable narrator. I think he just was trying to read the room on Jackie Gleason based on that moment. But I just thought it was funny that like when he says that he thinks Jackie Gleason didn't talk about it, that if we're gonna believe either the Esquire story or the memoir story, that he probably at least told his soon-to-be ex-wife about it.
Yeah, I mean, if he was in shock and stunned and, comes home and, he's got to tell somebody, right? Because he's not, I mean, I don't know. He would be in on the conspiracy as well.
Yeah, because like, with him and Nixon in particular, Dougie, I mean, obviously his career is out around UFOs, but for Jackie Gleason and Richard Nixon, this is like a thing that they're passionate about, that they can't get enough research. So for, I think that it's one of those things where I think for Jackie, it's like there's a difference between seeing the door and walking through the door. I think in this point, in this case, where he walked through the door and was he it wasn't quite what he expected. So again, like I know that we're kind of like done with this section, but I just wanted to mention is that like, with all three men in that room, what they may or may not have been thinking at that point. We will go to a little bit later on in 1974, despite everything going on at Watergate, Nixon was able to get an untraceable funding for Dougie and the UFO research.
Yeah.
And Nixon actually calls from the Oval Office on July 24th of 1974 to Dougie in Twin Peaks. And this is, at least according to Major Briggs, their last known conversation. Dougie is under the impression that he was drinking heavily and it was due to his speech impediment. Richard Nixon says that Dougie was right about Project Blue Book being a misdirection, like in one of their earlier conversations, and that a shadow government called the Wise Men was taking the big cases, and Dougie was basically chasing red herrings. Nixon also does tell Dougie about the UFO crashes that he recently discovered that happened in 1949 and 1948. The last one, 1958, having a survivor. So there's a lot to sink in terms of where Nixon's at with his career, about what he's spilling out about UFOs. What should we think about with Dougie that he's been on these cases for decades and he was basically chasing shadows when, according to Richard Nixon, there was much bigger fish to fry out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really something to chew on to get into the mind of Milford about what he would have thought at that point. I actually think, it's possible that Milford doesn't buy all of it. Like, he knows what he knows because he saw it. And so he has his own experience with it. So he believes it, that these things happen and that people have these experiences. He doesn't doubt that part of it. But is it possible that, when he's talking to Nixon, who's drunk and obviously becoming more paranoid and delusional, that maybe Dougie doesn't necessarily take it to heart that he's been chasing after shadows, right? I mean, because he has his own feel for it. There was one place in the book where it said that he could sniff out cases, blue book cases that weren't even on the list, right? Because he had a feel for it. So I think he takes it with a grain of salt. That's my story.
I think that the reason why I was like kind of taken into consideration is that when Dougie talks about that Nixon was like clearly drinking heavily, is that I know around this time that I think if it wasn't the first term, it definitely was the second term that Richard Nixon had a real alcohol problem. In fact, because we're around the era of Watergate, is that after he resigned with a pending impeachment coming, that he actually beat his wife in like an alcoholic rage. So the timeline at least adds up. And I feel like Dougie, or not Dougie, Nixon, this is his paranoia kind of at peak form. So there's that part of me that wonders if there are bigger cases out there. But this, because like we were talking about is that we have the Majestic 12, which was very much a shadowy government. The Wise Men, which is also not unlike the Majestic 12, was not really talked about in the secret history. It was just something that kind of popped up. So I do wonder if the Dougie was chasing some form of red herrings, but I do side with you is that with Dougie that, to him, because of all the stuff he saw throughout the decades, that, clearly this means something to him, that like, what he's seen was just not nothing to him.
Yeah, I mean, is it possible that that there are levels of the government that go beyond even what the president is privy to? Yeah, and I think Dougie could actually, even if he takes it with a grain of salt, I think he could also believe it too because he's seen a lot of stuff. I mean, he got taken to an alien. You know what I mean? Like, that's heavy. That's a big deal. I think it could be both.
I think the reason why I'm trying to challenge the veracity of Nixon, putting aside his lack of sobriety, is that he talks about how the Majestic 12 had been reverse engineering what the triangular UFO that we mentioned earlier. And Nixon thinks that there's up to six different types of species and six different types of species of aliens slash UFOs. And Nixon instructs Dougie to lay low, and he
Right.
mentions an FBI informant who may or may not be Goran Cole.
That's
So where.
cool. Come on. That's got to be cool, right? Come on, Colin.
Yeah, so when you mentioned earlier about Dougie assembling like some sort of like team with the funny UFOs, that might have been like almost like proto Blue Rose. I should mention is that there's a knock at the door during this phone call, and Nixon says he will never speak to Dougie again. And Dougie does, in my opinion, is just the dumbest thing that he could have done is that the next day in the Twin Peaks Post, he writes a pro defense letter for Nixon after he resigned. Major Briggs, he tries to build a case for it, but as we'll talk about later on, is that I think Major Briggs was trying to be charitable to his friend and mentor. Because the worst thing you could have done is that at a time when Watergate, when people start to realize that like you can challenge your presence, that presence can do unethical things to Americans, that making like a pro defense article in your own newspaper is just like it's like the most Streisand effect thing you could possibly do.
But isn't this kind of the same thing we were talking about earlier about defending people in the public square and not anticipating the amount of backlash that you would get for it, because as the person who is the defender, you wholeheartedly believe. Plus, you have your own newspaper, so you don't give a shit. You're like, I'm putting this in the paper. I mean, I agree with you. It seems ridiculous, especially knowing Dougie, but you know, he really believed in him, I guess, right?
I totally understand why Dougie would feel like he has to defend Nixon, because it wasn't just like a coworker or a boss. This was like seemingly a friend. It's just that I think that I have a hang up that Nixon tells Dougie to lay low and does the exact
Oh,
opposite,
right.
like right after his resignation. But now this one will actually lead to a bit of a time jump, and this will actually come to another relationship that Dougie will have, is that in July of 1982, he writes about the Briggs family arriving at Twin Peaks. You know, I think it's pretty clear that Milford and Briggs were in talks leading up to this event. This will be a relationship that, when you look at season two of Twin Peaks, it's kind of weird to think that these two would have a good bond for almost 10 years.
I know.
Because, you know, there's that part, I believe it's in 1979, that Major Briggs, he talks about finding an unidentified flying object, and the way that he anonymously reported it, it somehow tipped off Dougie that like this guy was like the right person to basically be a protege of sorts.
Yeah, and I guess that gets unfolded towards the more towards the end of the book, right? But yeah, I mean, again, it was like that it was that realization after being through the book so many times that this is them together. It's Briggs and Milford, and that they have a meeting of the minds, right? I mean, there's that one part at the end that we'll get to, but where Briggs, they're having their a conversation, and Briggs says to him, "You're not who I thought you were." Right? Because you could read that a lot of different ways, but they obviously have a connection and a certain level of trust between them.
Oh, absolutely. To kind of move on to a year later, Carl Rodd, once again, a weird kind of tangential interaction just because Dougie saw him get abducted in the like decades previous. But Carl Rodd, on May 9th, 1983, he writes something that makes its way to the Twin Peaks Post, that Carl is talking about what is alluding to potential shadow governments being on Blue Pine Mountain. And what happened was Dougie, he was not in the office, or he might have been out of town at the time that his assistant editor put it to print and then fired him. Dwayne actually was about to follow up on Carl Rodd's letter. And Dougie does this kind of like reverse psychology where he says that he'll take it upon himself to contact the FBI for Dwayne Milford. And this is where we get not only Goran Cole, but we get Philip Jeffries on May 28th of 1983, that they write a letter that what's going on with Blue Pine Mountain, it has to do with Reagan's Strategic Defense Force.
Yeah, the Star Wars.
And then it would actually be listening to it, what actually would be listening post Alpha. This would actually be up and fully operational by late November. This would be the thing that would continue the UFO investigation as Nixon almost 10 years prior was hoping for. This facility was completely off the books. Briggs was really the only one working alongside with Dougie. So now that we have like this whole thing going on with Blue Pine Mountain, this is like a core part of like season two. Like pretty much
Totally.
all the stuff with Major Briggs from throughout all the events of season two tie back to this event.
Right.
Anything we should keep in mind about how LPA or Listening Post Alpha operates?
Well, this is very shady. And Cole's involved in it, right? That they're like, first of all, they have to clear part of the forest, right? And then they're saying, "Oh, don't worry about this thing. They're using their jazz hands. Don't look over here. It's just this thing that the president wants to do, but it's totally not. It's a secret LPA, right? It's confidential and everything." So, Cole has a little bit of a, is involved in a little shady stuff here. I think that's really the only thing that I would say was of interest.
You know, we were talking about how Dougie Milford would be like the early days of the Blue Rose Task Force. I think that Dougie Milford was the type of person that he had to get his hands dirty in order for Blue Rose Task Force to be, I guess, a little less unethical. Because, you know, we were mentioning earlier about how Dougie Milford would silence people, like he would strong arm people to kind of keep
Right.
quiet. And I do maintain why he says that when it came to interacting with Einar Jennings, there was like this, like, we can make your death look like an accident. I
Right.
think with Goran Cole and Philip Jeffries, they found a way to be more diplomatic about it, where yes, they are lying, and yes, like what it is quite frankly a shadow government. But I don't think that Goran Cole or Philip Jeffries come from a place of like anything insidious. I think it's just like something they have to do, because it's like what Major Briggs talks about, is that Listening Post Alpha, it not only appears into deep space, but in the woods of Twin Peaks, which is a very
Right.
central part, because It's like everything we talked about that went on with like Pearl Lakes or like anywhere near Owl Cave or even the sycamore trees, the 12 sycamore trees. There's a lot of activity that's going on in the vicinity of the woods of Twin Peaks. So I think that at least Goran Cole, Philip Jeffries, and Dougie Milford, they wouldn't be doing this unless they felt like they absolutely positively had to.
Yeah, I mean, look at Nixon gave them like, what did it say? Unlimited funds. I mean, this was really important. And now the FBI, what it was, he said, construct a team of people from different areas of the government, right? It's what how you were going to like put this group of people together. But I guess I don't really mean to imply that Cole is shady necessarily. It seems like it's just part of the gig, right? If you're going to work for the FBI isn't always clean. It can't, it just, it just can't be, especially because there are so many secrets.
I think this is actually a good thing to mention because I think of when Major Briggs, it's when he talks to Dale Cooper in early on in season two, that he talks about how he finds secrecy to be repugnant, but he will honor that because that is what he agreed to do.
Right.
I think that this is pretty emblematic of like what he is doing is that like, he doesn't like what he's doing, but he's trying to do it in the most ethical way possible while honoring the institution that he's working for. I think this is a good time to mention the secret recorded conversation that Dougie and Major Briggs have in May 17th of 1985, that it's talks about approaching the unknown and seeking the truth. And Dougie asks if Briggs is willing to pass the threshold. Briggs talks about retaining an internal independence of his mind, and he attributes that to his parents. Dougie actually thinks that this is a contradiction of their lifestyle. Both talk about mysteries, and for Major Briggs, it's the ability to create wonder. Dougie actually completely disagrees that faith is any real factor into the mysteries. And actually, it's like I was saying before, is that with Major Briggs, is that he caught that UFO sighting in August of 1979. The anonymous report was through Mutual Unidentified Flying Object Network,
Yeah,
which
move on.
Dougie discovered. Dougie talks about this is exactly what he was looking for when he saw Briggs, and he tells Briggs that he's going to be his replacement to be the quote unquote watcher of the woods. And this is when, I talked about it before, but Dougie reveals the three triangular marks on his forearm to Major Briggs. Obviously, they've been working with each other for a while and they can work professionally, but they can also kind of like have a friendly clash of sorts. With Major Briggs, he's talking about how he's willing to pass through the threshold. And like, I think faith is that final barrier to entry. I think that's the one where they're really clashing with each other on that. Do you side with Dougie or Garland on this one?
I side with Dougie. I'm not a, I don't, and that is an interesting question too, when you're talking about mystery and in regards to faith. I mean, because faith in and of itself is believing without understanding. You just believe it even though you don't understand it. And so in some things you have to have faith. I mean, just in general, but when it comes to spirituality, that's another topic. And that's, we know Briggs is a spiritual person, right? I mean, he claims it. He's Catholic. So, yeah, I'm more on the Dougie side on this one. How about you?
I think there's something to be said about Major Briggs and that faith is that final barrier to him. Because, it's like we see it in the missing pieces where, like after working, at Blue Pine Mountain all day, he is willing to go home and just read like the Book of Revelations out loud to Betty. And when you watch that scene, the missing pieces, you don't get the impression that's really the first or last time they would do that sort of activity. He seems to have something intuitive that like he it's almost like, that scene in Indiana Jones' Last Crusade, for example. There's a scene when Indiana Jones, he has to take that leap of faith, and it looks like a bottomless chasm, and he's doing it very begrudgingly. But then not only does he find there's a path, but it reveals that there's always been a path there. I think that with Major Briggs, I think that allegory with The Last Crusade sticks very well.
I like it.
There's just something about like, that's the final barrier that Indiana Jones goes through to get to the Holy Grail. And I don't want to veer off too much about Indiana Jones, but I think there's something to be said about faith and how it's integrated. That it's this thing that like, I think there's something about like the fact that you have to take that leap of faith is like the biggest gamble to do this type of career, the way that Major Briggs does. So I don't know. I just think it's kind of like an interesting contrasting of the two.
Yeah, except that Milford doesn't have that same perspective, but he also has followed a lifelong path in service to his government, in service to something greater in his own, whatever he thinks that might be. There's something just with the, with the inclusion of the Ezekiel passage here that Mark Frost puts in earlier in the book, that there is also an intersection of angels and spirituality and UFOs, and right, that because at one point Dougie says something about like the experience that he had when he was like, I can't remember, did he have an abduction experience? Doug, is that alluded to? Whatever his experience was, the middle one, that it felt like a like almost like a religious conversion. He uses that language, and but it's in quotes. And so I think that it's just an it's an opportunity to look at this from all angles, by faith or pure science or pure logic, or however you look at it. Yeah, I would say, I agree with you that it would be also very easy to approach it in a way that you couldn't possibly do this work without faith. I get that.
I think another one, and I think that it's left to be deliberately ambiguous, but I think of earlier on in the secret history that there's that page from the Bible. It's from the book of Ezekiel, and it's talking about in context of the Bible, it's talking about these angels, these of like a higher order, about how it's like these four different faces, and the way that it moves is that I believe it's Briggs, definitely Tammy. They talk about how the way that these angels are described and how they move, that it's not unlike UFOs. So
Right.
it's a very vague connection, but I think that's like the only thing I could use to, as far as I can, substantiate Major Briggs' claim about that there's that faith being that final barrier to entry. Because I don't know, just like, I mean, I guess now that I think about it, Major Briggs would probably put that page of the Bible in under, I don't want to say his own biases, but at the same time, like if he wasn't Catholic, that page probably wouldn't be there.
Yeah, maybe not. But it's also, it reminds me as you're saying it too about the barrier to entry that you need faith. Otherwise, you can't go past. It's the dweller on the threshold, right? It's like you have to have perfect courage. So you need something within yourself, whatever it is you're going to call it, that gives you the ability to rise above your fear. And that's courage, faith, whatever you want to call it.
And I also think of when Dougie refers to Major Briggs as the Watcher of the Woods, there's something like almost fantastical about that description, because it's like we were talking about is that the woods of Twin Peaks are very vital into not just the mythos of what we see in the show, but just that the woods have something going on, that there's something really deep and possibly just mostly insidious. Again, it depends on how you look at it, but there is something to be said about you watch being like in the skeleton crew and you are the Watcher of the Woods, that he will probably be the only one for a while to be doing this job. As we're approaching near the end of the dossier, Briggs does talk about how by the time we get to the late 80s, that very few people in Twin Peaks know about Dougie's youthful days or even his military career for that matter. Dougie apparently wore a really bad toupee for that time. His conservative politics started to soften up in the Twin Peaks post. The only thing that might have drawn attention was that he was wealthy way beyond what a military pension could offer, and he didn't hide it either. He got divorced four times, three of which were since his return to Twin Peaks. The other, I believe, was Pauline Cuyo from decades past.
Yes.
I know I was saying this before about when Dougie wrote the pro-defense Nixon article, but he's really not good at hiding how he feels. Like, for someone who was so secretive for decades, like this should be a red flag, like to anyone in the military, of this guy who's like spending all this money, who knows all these secrets.
Right, because so, but I mean, and that's an it is it's the dichotomy of his personality too, because obviously he's using that money. Right. I mean, that's where it's coming from. He's embezzling the money that's being given to him to spend on cars and clothes and wives and whatever. But when he talks about his past to Briggs, again, it goes back to feelings. So, on the one hand, you're right. He's like this person who can be dispassionate and loyal and trustworthy and totally tight-lipped and not give up anything. And then in this one part of the conversation, Briggs says he grinned, meaning Milford, and he said, I lived a wild, dissipated youth brought on by emotional problems caused by the disturbing experiences I had in the woods as a kid. I didn't know how to begin to handle what I'd seen or felt, so I tried to drink them away. For the better part of a decade, I was a little more than a drifter. The war and the army gave me a structure to hang a life on. So, but I mean, it's like he's divulging this very vulnerable, as we said earlier, this is, I think, what you were saying when they have this conversation, this very vulnerable side of him, which is completely antithetical to the part that is the spook who goes around and threatens people.
Admittedly, this is the start where we kind of get away from the introspective part of Dougie Milford and we get to the characteristic part of Dougie Milford leading into season two. And again, like in 1990, 1991, if someone said that, oh, this guy is the mentor of Major Briggs, no one would have believed it because, you know, like we have to talk about Lana Budding because I think she's 19, or at least that's what she's like at the age that she claims at that point. She meets Dougie before his 80th birthday, which huge age gap. That's a bit of a yikes on definitely Dougie's part. But he meets her when she worked at the Twin Peaks Savings and Loan and may have found out how much Dougie was really worth. And meeting in the safety deposit box where they happened to be locked there for an hour. And by the time they got to the door unlocked, that he was just head over heels for her. And he keeps that pretty quiet. This has to be off screen during the events of the original series because the marriage announcement is that of all places, Leland's Wake, talking about wedding her. And I know that there's debate on how much people really know or don't know about Leland at the time of this wake. But I think regardless, even if like everyone outside of Cooper and Sarah Palmer and Harry Truman, even if they're the only ones to know about like Leland and what he did to Laura, this is still a really bad way to handle yourself at a wake.
Such a bumbling thing to again, right? It's such a dichotomy to be this person who can handle this incredibly intense work. And then, but in your professional life, but in your personal life, you're a mess. I mean, not a mess, but you're just bumbling. He doesn't know how to be social.
And to be fair to Dougie, is that even though he is petty and that he would like almost come to fists with Dwayne and would storm out, Dwayne was the one who wasn't pushing back either. Like he's the mayor of Twin Peaks and he's acting like a total buffoon as well. And he's like the more responsible one out of the two, certainly publicly. When Dougie Milford storms out, the next time we see him is at the wedding itself. This is where Dwayne Milford again coming across as a total buffoon. He already objects, but at this point, everyone kind of knew that was going to happen, so they're just kind of like, whatever, let's just go for it. But apparently, Dougie, he said before he went to that suite that night, because you know it seems like the wedding reception went pretty well, but people seem to have a good enough time. But he said before he went to that suite is that he's glad that he keeps his minister on speed dial. And then he's found the next day and he's wearing a green ring. There's ambiguity of like whether it would be the owl cave ring, but I think that Tammy confirms in the final dossier that it's a jade green ring and it was found on him at his death. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up and why I think it's important that Tammy addresses this is that in the secret history, there's this, I guess like they allude to the idea that Lana may or may not be an assassin. For the longest time, I thought that was just the most bizarre and ridiculous way you
I
could take
know.
what was already, quite frankly, a ridiculous character. But
Agree.
with him wearing the ring and with the way we see the properties of the ring in the return, I think there's a credence to this because, you know, I'm thinking in the return, you know, Mr. C, he makes Raymond Rowe put on, then he shoots him, he goes to the Red Room. Or in part 17, after Lucy shoots Mr. C, it's, you know, Cooper says, under no circumstances do you touch that body. And then he puts the ring on Mr. C, who goes to the Red Room. So I kind of wonder with Dougie Milford, with him wearing the ring, do you think Lana placed it on him, or do you think it was something that he just happened to have the owl cave ring at this time?
No, I think it was Lana. I always thought Lana was a denizen. She just her character was so weird, and I just thought she had that thing where all the men were like, their tongues are hanging out, and so she had some kind of a power that was sure sex appeal, and you could use that. But I just felt like Lana was a Black Lodge person, spirit, or whatever you want to call it, and that she needed Dougie's money, and then she didn't need him, and then because she what was her mission to deal with the Twin Peaks. The Miss Twin Peaks contest. I don't know. It's a long, winding theory, but I agree. I mean, we saw in the original series, you see the ring on his finger. You don't know it's the owl cave ring, but he does have a ring on, right? I seem to remember. So that's always been a question. Did he have the owl cave ring? But under these circumstances, I think it's totally reasonable to think that Lana put a owl cave ring on, because that's always been a question too. Is there only one?
I always thought there was one personally, and with that mindset, I do wonder because the last time we see the ring is when Laura puts it on at the end of Fire Walk with Me. So with you saying that Lana being a potentially lodge adjacent or a lodge entity in of itself, that would imply that she had to get it from the Red Room in some capacity for it to get to Dougie, or Dougie kind of knew something about the woods. I would go with Lana because what I wrote down is that Briggs is under the impression that she was a paid assassin and was hired by someone from Dougie's past to silence his many secrets. Briggs says he has no real evidence at all, but it's like we were saying before, is that Dougie's really bad about hiding his wealth and his power. If he's like, has this money well beyond a military pension, which military pensions, I'm sure even with inflation, were really good in the 80s. I think the fact that someone from his past would try to silence him is not the craziest thing I can think of.
Agreed, totally. He probably had tons of people, just in the way that he silenced people. There were probably people who didn't want him talking at all. And again, yeah, I mean, wait, but so didn't Roundtree, she was the last one to have the ring.
Oh, that's after the events of season two, though.
Yeah.
Like, so yeah, what
I
would
mean,
happen is that Dougie would have the ring.
oh, right.
Lana may or may not have it, but I am curious about, like, I would say that the ring isn't in the season two finale, but there's that altar that Annie stands by when she appears and then disappears. So I think there's something about her being associated with the ring and also having it in the missing pieces. So Dougie and Lana are this weird, bizarre equation that
I
I
know.
don't know how it factors in.
Yeah, same, but I like it.
But given that not only was Dougie wearing a jade green ring in the original series, but the fact that Tammy explicitly mentioned it in the final dossier, as silly as the whole Lana being a paid assassin, as bizarre as that
I
is,
know.
I think with Tammy writing that down and everything she knows about the ring and who it was passed to, the fact that Dougie Milford was affiliated with this ring by this then present day says, speaks volumes to me.
Yeah, and that, they have a meet cute in the bank. I mean, I don't know. I just think it sounded like a setup to me.
No, that's where I stand. Although I guess, before we really, wrap up on Dougie, do you have any thoughts about in the event that he was taken to the Red Room? Do you think that he had a certain fate awaiting for him because of the person that he was?
That's a really good question. So why people, yeah, I mean, I guess the question is, why do people end up there? Is it all bad? Some people go in who are not all bad, right? Why do you end up there? So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to envision Dougie in the Red Room, in the Black Lodge, like to become a denizen because he was so dead when we saw him. You know what I mean? I mean, of course, Laura's dead, but she ends up in the lodge. You're whatever that part of you goes there. Maybe. I mean, but that goes back to the whole, it is kind, there's kind of a religious or spiritual aspect to that, really, that does your physical body dies, but your soul goes somewhere, right? So yeah, I don't know. What do you think? Did Dougie go to the lodge?
I think he did. The one thing I'm thinking of is that when Hawk explains, the Black Lodge and the White Lodge to Dale Cooper, he talks about with the Black Lodge that everyone has to pass through it, and if you face it with imperfect courage, it will annihilate your soul. I guess I'll have to explain more as we go further, but I think he actually did pass through it with perfect courage.
Yeah, I think so too.
The reason why I'm bringing that up is that Briggs, after he returns from like his disappearance for those handful of days, he actually finds a letter from Dougie that was from the day of Leland's wake, and what may or may not have been written like right before, or actually right after, rather, when Major Briggs went missing. And Dougie expresses regret to Garland into bringing him in all of this. He views that all of his military achievements rather unfavorably. And also, he says that Bobby and Betty need Garland more than Dougie needs Garland. So I think there's some like there's an introspection that Dougie has that like he's starting to admit that he's done a lot of things wrong in his career, that like these are very hollow victories for him. And I think there's a courage of like identifying your true self, especially in your final days. Once again, not unlike Laura Palmer, who we've strangely paralleled with the two of them. She does the
Right.
same thing in her last 7 days, where like she asks these like very tough questions and she confronts these like true evils. So it's definitely not the poignant story for Dougie as it is for Laura, but I think there are some parallels to it. And I think the fact that Dougie talks about how he thinks that Bobby and Betty need him, because I think it's around this time that Garland he talks about how Bobby has been like going off the rails and he kind of rationalized it, but he hoped that like it would just sort itself out, but he does realize that his neglect effectively is what may or may not have prompted Bobby to be in that life. So I think that like Dougie does have that positive influence to Garland, as we see with the vision scene in the season two premiere, that Dougie he at least is seeing a bigger picture now. That's not just him and his career or the things that bring him pleasure, but there's like a much, much larger thing that people should be worried about.
Totally. I agree. I think this final letter that Briggs gets from him has a lot of impact on him because he does subsequently reflect on his own life, like you said, and his misgivings about how he spent so much time on his career and being at the LPA, and that his one son had suffered so much, maybe by the lack of his involvement in his life. I mean, Briggs was always a deep thinker, right? He was an empath. He was a loving man. He had his faith. He loved his family. And so he would be someone very open to having this kind of discourse with another male, especially, you know, because I don't know, my experience, males aren't always the most emotionally expressive. And Milford's letter to him is like, I've read it so many times, Colin. The penultimate paragraph of it is just like, it's just so meaty and good. It's just such beautiful writing. I'd like, you know, I mean, throughout this whole thing, Mark Frost's storytelling, I just think is so awesome. But yes, I think that this letter definitely had an impact on Briggs' perspective.
And I will say, because I know you and me have listened to the audiobook, is that, you know, Robert Knepper, who most people know as one of the Mitchum brothers, is that
Yes.
he is the voice of Dougie Milford. And I like Robert Knepper's performance as Dougie Milford in the audiobook, but this is the scene where he really nails it, where I think
Totally.
his delivery of these lines actually outdoes Roni Mitchum in The Return.
Yeah, I've listened to it many times. I mean, in just Googling stuff about the secret history, somebody took the audiobook and clipped that paragraph, maybe one more out of that section of the audiobook, and put it to some really just weird music and then images from Twin Peaks that the person edited together to go with text, kind of just his own out of his own imagination, but it was so powerful. I mean, it's really the content could be applied at any time. It's universal.
Actually, I know we were talking about before about Dougie starting to, like, you know, admit, like, he's reflecting on his life in a very honest manner. I think this kind of builds up because, you know, as he's in this letter to Garland, he's weary of authority, saying it failed both of them. And he's saying this all happened before Roswell. And what he's really been looking for comes from the trees. You know, we were talking about before is that trees are very, like, prominent in Twin Peaks, and there's something very spiritual about them. He believes that everything scientific, religious, and spiritual emanates from the trees, says that we're all utterly incapable of understanding their true intent, that they may be good and evil, and how humanity is in the middle of all of it. He also says that the owls may not be what they seem, but they remind us to look into the darkness. Also, he tells Briggs to wait for his control to appear. Briggs, actually, when he hears the word control, he instantly thinks of Dale Cooper. I guess to end with Dougie in particular, is that now that Briggs wants to have Cooper as his mentor, it at least seems like at that point that Cooper will be the next person to be the Watcher of the Woods. Put aside that that doesn't quite play out as expected, that Dougie would be cremated and would have his ashes scattered in Pearl Lakes. Probably the most important part, Lana not being among this small group.
Right.
That's the end of Dougie's, like, long, arduous life from 1909 to 1989. I know we went through quite a bit in terms of his life, his career, the real life people that he's seen, the pros and cons of being in his career, working with Major Briggs. Is there anything we should keep in mind before we close out today's episode?
I guess just, you know, as I said to you before we started the call today, just the feeling that I've been having this week after being so immersed in this about him. You know, I don't know if I would call him an anti-hero necessarily, if he totally fits that bill, but just how multifaceted human beings are. And they're not all good and they're not all bad. Again, like this, the tension between good and evil, the whole book sets up this fight between the Masons and the Illuminati. So there's this tension always pulling at that thread throughout the whole book. And I think it is, as far as Douglas is concerned, I guess it still makes me want to know more. That's how I feel. Even though, look at, we've wrung it out, Colin. I mean, we told the story, but there's so much in between the lines. I mean, you could approach him in so many ways because we have to fill in the blanks.
I like how the way he ends that letter to Garland, because he talks about how the trees, like, just how important they are to, like, everything, and why being the Watcher of the Woods is so pivotal for both him and Garland. But also, I think the fact that he openly says that we will never truly understand them, because when it comes to ending anything relative to Twin Peaks, trying to explain it is, like, it just doesn't land for me. So I think the fact that Dougie, our arguably central character of the secret history, that he like at the end of like this long storied career just says that no, there's a lot more going on that we'll never understand. Again, it's like what I was saying before is that, you know, when he passes through, the Black Lodge, that he would face this with perfect courage because he seems to have a pretty good introspection of the world according to that letter to Garland.
For sure. It's so beautifully written. And again, it's that thing where you don't get much about who he is as a person through this story. You just have a lot of his actions, except in those moments where he goes back to his emotional distress over his life experiences as a young person. And then, of course, seeing his interactions with the others, or whatever you want to call, right, the space beings, whatever you want to call them. And so that it makes him a complex person, but also I totally came to really appreciate the fact during this go around of my reading that he was always willing to not just say what he did or saw, but how he felt about it. Yeah, definitely. It showed his human side.
And I think that closes up today's episode. Before we close out, was there any social media you want to plug or tell anyone that you know what you're up to?
Let's see, what am I up to? So I'm on Instagram. I think it's agent.ivy is my IG handle. And I don't post a lot, but anything I post is usually Twin Peaks related. And I think this is probably the biggest thing that I could possibly promote is that I'm doing this show today, which I'm really excited about. So I will be talking about that a lot when it comes out. And I'm already looking forward to Twin Peaks Day 25.
No, but I want to thank you for coming on because I know talking about Dougie Milford requires a lot of attention, but given how much love you show for the secret history, as shown actually in my Annie Wershing In Memoriam, that like you clearly respect like the material and understand it very well. So I know it's not an easy task to talk about Dougie Milford at such a magnitude, but I just want to thank you for everything.
Thank you, Colin. This was really, really awesome.
When the twilight is gone and no songbirds are singing, when the twilight is gone, you come into my heart, and here in my heart you will stay while I pray. Close to mine.